Okay. This morning, Ellie asked me to stand in for Rabbi Friedman, so I didn't really have much time to conduct a comprehensive assessment of what messages I wanted to leave you with, not leave you with, what does it take to succeed. So see, this is just off-the-cuff stream of consciousness. I also had a Levaya today, so I've just been running around, but I just wanted to give my two shekels about what it takes to succeed. And I want to divide today's sicha, actually into four parts, but the last part, if you have any questions, I want to try to respond to them. And again, this is in the end, hopefully over Shabbos we'll be together. But certainly to start you thinking, those of you who are going back next year, and other people will speak with you as well. Think of it as five, or three, five, and eight. Three means, what are the three goals that I would challenge you to if I were speaking at your commencement in college? Let's say I were speaking at a commencement, I was invited, having nothing to do with yeshiva. What would I want out of someone who has been through a great experience, how to parlay that experience to the next level, and hopefully allow it to infuse your life? In psychotherapy, it's called mindfulness. We're able to assimilate and intake experiences that are great and actually transition them or transform your life and experience rather than segmenting them. We go through something fantastic, and then you're drunken, and you move on to the next chapter. Think of compartmentalization and mindfulness or assimilation as opposites. So how do you assimilate and allow it to infuse your life? What are the three attitudes, what are the three sentiments I think are helpful to try to stretch the experience and the inspiration and allow it really to characterize who you become as you're forging your identity? That's three. Five are, what are the values of Gush? When you walk out of here, if you want to try to bottle the secret sauce, again, I haven't really sat here and given a lot of attention, I'm just scribbling on the way, but what do I think, if you want to summarize, what do I think we stand for? What's our coat of arms? What does it mean? What am I to take away from this yeshiva so that you're able to not just think about transitioning and assimilating, but what are the ideas I want to assimilate? Not just every time you go through something special and extraordinary, you want to assimilate and integrate it, but what makes it so unique and what makes it so defining and so spectacular? And then the eight is practical tools. Be careful about this, be careful about that, pay attention to this, pay attention to that. Not just theoretically, what are the values I want to try to assimilate, but how do I practically, what are the devices and apparatuses to make sure that I remain faithful to what I've been through over the course of, a very, very exciting couple of years when you leave yeshiva, very formative years, of course, even a lifetime. Obviously, you're not going to remember everything that every single Rebbe said, but here and there something will stick, here and there something will embed itself in your subconscious, and then experience later down the road will awaken it, will evoke it. Oh, you know, this corresponds to what Rabbi so-and-so was saying, and then all of a sudden the words could be helpful and can be somehow illuminating. Okay, so let's start with three. What are the three sentiments to live the type of life? Forget the fact that you were in Gush or in yeshiva, but what does it mean? What type of identity do we hope that you can build and take going forward? I would divide them into three. Number one, to treasure the experiences you've had. Very often in life you take things for granted. I think as Americans, for sure, you feel more entitled than your counterparts who have less resources and have less of a paved road. And we know this educationally. It's no one's fault here. I'm not going to lambast you. Oh, you Americans, you're so spoiled. It's not your fault, anyone in particular. But a culture with so many resources provided for you so easily, very often it's easy to take things for granted in life, to take people for granted in life, to take fantastic experiences for granted in life, and that's a handicap. You don't realize something spectacular has happened, something you should treasure, something you should value, something very unique, something that stands out. It's not just the regular year that you went through the educational model, but people have spent time creating hopefully a model which inspired you. People are hard at work, giving every fiber of their being as much as they can to juggle their personal lives, their professional lives, to try to serve you, to try to cultivate you, hopefully selflessly, hopefully respectfully, in a great institution with such legacy. Just everything you've experienced and enjoyed, just take a few steps back and treasure. And of course, when you treasure something, you also want to feel, and I'll get back to this a little bit later, the sense of duty. Why did Hashem provide you this opportunity, this treasure, when others didn't benefit in the same model? Whether in life, in general, the talents that Kodesh Baruch Hu blessed you with, the faculties, the fact that Baruch Hashem you're healthy, Baruch Hashem you're successful, Baruch Hashem by and large your family backgrounds are stable, and in general, count your blessings. And in particular, this is an experience which happened to just fall into your lap. How many people here can say they had a clear sense? I was choosing the yeshivas and I knew how spectacular this was for me and I chose it. Some cases, yes. In many cases, it fell into your lap. You met the right interviewer, the right recruiter. You met the right person. You were fortunate enough to have fallen into his grill, fallen into his grid, and he was, whatever happened, whatever serendipity, had a brother, whatever. So just treasure something and then turn that into some mission in life that now that I've received something, you never want to just be a recipient. That's the road to selfish or self-absorbed behavior. Anytime you're a recipient, I've told you this year, as we've talked about minyan, as we've talked about presence and scheduling, and just if you're part of a community, you receive so much. No one was here in yeshiva by themselves, and you all received so much in life in this year, and you were enriched in so many fashions by all the resources that have been assembled. You want to be a contributor, not a taker, not someone who consumes. You want to be a contributor. Obviously, you're also a recipient, you're also a beneficiary. So just take a step back and treasure and assess, and not everything is perfect, and you don't want to look at everything through rose-colored glasses, but by and large, I hope you have a very positive and favorable view on what you've experienced, and take stock of this year is a unique year. I'm 50 years old. If I look back at the 3 or 4 years in my life that stand out, certainly my year or two in Gush post-high school, when I was really being formed, my identity is really being shaped, those are the 2 years that stand out. I can't tell you that 3 years ago was a standout year. I can't tell you that 10 years ago was a standout year. It's part of my life, part of my experience, part of hopefully a life of mission and a life, but this is a special year, and it has to be silhouetted as such, and it has to be highlighted as, that's why it hurts me so much when I hear all these unhealthy, and I think counterproductive idioms, your gap year, take a year off, get on with your life, whatever your decisions are, this is not a gap year, this is not a parenthesis, this is not a vacuum, this is a year that you've been able to walk away from the pressures, the pettiness, the frenetic pace, the culture, the parental pressures, take a step back and search for identity and try to start building identity. And that's the way to lead a very deep life. And Baruch Hashem, you'll be able to build the identity in such a rich pool of resources and Torah-oriented values. That's number one, to treasure. It's important to treasure in life in general. People don't have the capacity anymore to treasure. We're moving so quickly. We're exchanging items so quickly. We don't even know that word sounds ancient. It sounds like a pirate's treasure. But treasure or relish or value, those are ancient-sounding words, but I'd like them to become more a part of your vernacular. Treasure people and certainly treasure experiences. Number two, what's your vision? Where are you headed? Where will you be in 10 years? Where will you be in 20 years? Obviously, as you cast your vision further down the road, it's harder to have a clear and precise. It becomes very obscure, very vague. Just have some sense of where this is all heading to put it together so that your actions in the present can somehow be oriented towards some long-term. It may not be as programmatic and as precisely causal in the sense of I take a step in 2016, how will it affect my experience in 2036? But a general sense of what are the values I'm fighting for? What are the behavior I have to defend? What person do I want to become? In the immediate moment, it's hard to see the value of defending a value or of discipline or of avoiding experience which seems fun and exciting, which could be harmful morally, religiously. But if you look at the broader picture, so that's a transient passing moment, and there'll be long-term, and hopefully we've spoken enough this year, I know in my share about vision, long-term planning, what do you want to become? Again, life's going to change a lot. You don't want to be imprisoned by vision. You don't want to be a slave to your early models and your early altars. You're going to be able to break free. And Baruch Hashem, they say we've tried to encourage you to break free. But now that you've broken free, you've started to think about identity. What are the values you'd like to live implemented? And obviously there'll be moments of indiscretion, moments of inconsistency, moments of weakness, moments of underperformance. But at least that vision lets you right the ship. In some cases, I've steered a little bit off course. Now let me move the rudder a little bit to the left, a little more to the left to compensate. Okay, the next day I've got to recover. But there's a sense that you're still heading in the overall direction. Sometimes we're too micro-scrutinizing. We micro-scrutinize the day-to-day, but we don't macro-scrutinize. What do we want to become? What are the long-term plans? So it's a sense of vision. What are the values you want to live and you want to represent for yourself, for others, for your family, for people who you haven't met? Most of the people that are going to really, really occupy your lives haven't even entered your world yet. You're going to marry someone. You're going to spend Mirat Hashem your life, hopefully in a loving relationship. You're going to have children in Mirat Hashem, grandchildren, colleagues that are going to occupy. You're still at the cusp of adulthood. And at that cusp, you haven't really met the people that are going to occupy and experience this world with you. So you have to start introducing their voices and their presence. Obviously, you don't know how they're going to look and how they're going to... But a sense of, I want to be a father, I want to be a husband, I want to be a member of a community, I want to represent certain values. So that sense of vision. And then finally, which is a little bit related to vision, but I want to itemize it as a separate word, idealism. Hopefully what we've been able to cultivate are boys that are going to live their lives as idealists. And idealism means, I know sometimes it sounds like highfalutin words, very grandiose, people who put ideas and ideals before convenience, comfort, exigency, affluence. People who see personal experience as a tool and a medium to achieve something larger. So you have to eat, and you have to earn a living, and you have to have a home to live in, and it has to be comfortable, each person based on their own standard. But that's not the end point. It's a medium for personal happiness, well-being, family bliss, so that I can fill in the blank. What are the ideals? Hopefully those blanks are high-minded ideals, and hopefully those ideals are embedded within Torah and Jewish experience and who we are as a people, more or less in that order. So hopefully those are three sentiments that you can concentrate on, and even for the boys who are staying next year and you're not immediately re-entering that society, it's a nice hiatus to take a few steps back and crystallize this experience and quantify it and then prepare for your second year and to now going forward, how do I reinforce, how do I solidify these three goals? Namely, I want to look back at my year treasure. I want to have a vision of what I want to be at some point. And hopefully that agenda is idealistic, is driven by ideals, living beyond myself. The more you live beyond yourself, the more noble, the more remarkable, the more redeemed, the more uplifting, the more inspiring, rather than just living to get the degree, receive the salary, and participate in other people's lives in minimal fashion. So that's the three. Those are the three sentiments I would encourage you to think about as you transition out of your first year. Now, what are the five? What are the values, of course? What do we represent aside from the obvious? Right? Every yeshiva in the world has to subscribe to the goal of creating religiously driven, religiously passionate, religiously excellent, what we call Ovdei Hashem, Yirei Shamayim, call it as you'd like, people that take religion seriously, who are strict adherents to halacha, rabbinic authority. Every yeshiva looks to create that. Different styles, different techniques, different medium, but that's our common goal. So I don't want you to think that that's not the obvious, that's the baseline. But what are some of the less than obvious elements and aspects of your experience that I want you to bottle and live your life by? What are these creeds? So number one, what some people call modern orthodoxy, I hate that term. I don't refuse to be entrapped by ideologies and by labels, and I don't want to be called a modern orthodox Jew. I live my life as a Jew. I've got certain peculiar approaches, not peculiar, but unique approaches to my avodas Hashem, to the degree that you find that similar. That's why you came to this yeshiva, not to another yeshiva, but I'd like to be inspired by every Jew that takes himself seriously and takes religion seriously, and I can emulate their experiences and try to grow from their experiences, and I'll talk about this later. But what makes the type of approach that you've primarily been exposed to here in yeshiva and to a degree in your background, what makes that different? It's a sense of, on the one hand, strict, unqualified, unflinching commitment to halacha. I never really said this to you, Moshe, maybe you just wait for a second, but there's one term I never had the chance this year to share with you my five pet peeves, the terms that I hate people using. And one of the terms that I hate is when people use the term ultra-Orthodox. If you use that term about anyone but yourself, you're copping out. If you feel there's another approach to orthodoxy that's ultra-Orthodox, you have every moral responsibility to become that. Because every Jew has to strive to ultra-Orthodoxy. That's the goal of every Jew. If you feel, so to speak, that the Haredi approach is more frum in our jargon than this approach, then you have every moral responsibility and all honesty to yourself to become Haredi. And I will assist that. I'll enable that because I want you to become as serious and passionate about religious observance as you can. So I refuse to use the word ultra-Orthodox about any sector because I want to see myself as an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I prefer the term Haredi or black hat because that's a sociological denomination. But I don't see my approach to Avodas Hashem as any less from, I'm not any less committed. It's an important statement because if you see yourself as less, you acquit yourself and you excuse yourself. And you, well, I'm not really ultra-Orthodox and therefore I can skim and I can exempt myself and I can skirt certain issues. Because after all, I don't self-define as that Orthodox. I'm moderately Orthodox. I mean to punish you, Moshe, but I didn't want you to miss that little clip. So in our world, it's that steadfast commitment to halacha, to Talmud Torah, to seriousness of davening, to quiet of davening, in the area of ritual, in the area of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, religious observance, but a view of the world in a favorable sense. It's not a world that's defeatist, it's futile, that's empty, that's satanic, that's dangerous, that it provides certain dangers, it's confusing, it's challenging, but it also provides potential. And the complexity of the human condition, that life isn't led black and white, that human beings are different, and there isn't a one formula that can service every human experience, human identity, that the Gentiles are not afterthoughts, that Kodesh Baruch Hu's creation, that the religious experience, not halacha, But the religious experience, the broader religious experience, can morph and transition with time. So, for example, the role of women in our society has to be adapted. So we can't alter halacha, but we certainly want to extend education and different roles in the religious harmony and the religious experience, not by violating halacha. And, of course, the emergence of Israel and the emergence of Jewish nationhood. So it's that union of classic, conventional, ritual-based, unflinching commitment to Torah, to halacha, coupled with a sense of the broader world around you, to engage in that world, to redeem that world, to participate in that world, but in that order. And I think sometimes boys confuse that order. Think of it as a base and think of it as an expansion, or think of it as a center as opposed to the periphery. I think that's what sometimes boys misunderstand about the yeshiva, certainly in my opinion. The core has to be solid. You see, so many people come to the yeshiva, they get so enchanted and so intrigued by the hashkafa and the philosophy and the view of the world and openness and engagement and participation and complexity and integration and assimilation, but that center collapses. And you can only afford yourself that luxury to integrate if that center is steadfast, and that commitment to Torah, to Yerusha Mayim. That's why I felt Rav Lichtenstein's presence here was so formative and so solidifying, because no one could ever doubt his piety, and no one could ever doubt his erudition, and no one could ever doubt his asmada, and in our jargon, no one could ever doubt his firmkeit. He was the firmest person on the block, so to speak. And then he allowed us the luxury and the confidence, given that baseline, that pedestal, to be favorable to the world around us, to be believers in humanity, not to look askance at Gentiles, to be adaptive and progressive without violating that core. But that core is harder. That core is work. That core is showing up to davening and working hard at mitzvahs and working hard at learning Torah. It's easier to imbibe, or it's easier to ingest and to consume the gush speak, so to speak, the philosophy and the ideology and the openness and the approach to the world, than it is to mimic the day-to-day activity of religion. And that's why for so many people, or to say differently, the hashkafa is easier than the Eved Hashem, than to be an Eved Hashem. But it's that combination to be an Eved Hashem, a stalwart, rock-solid Eved Hashem, and then because your Avodas Hashem translates into an engagement with the world around you, so to try to open your eyes rather than blind them to the world around you. So that's an important value, and I really am actually very appreciative there, but even after going for a wedding, the chance to clarify this to you, that there's so many people, some cases it's intentional, it's conscious, and some cases it's just because one is easier than the other, so they fall into the easiest. But my assumption is that idealists don't choose the easy path, they choose the path of greater meaning. Which brings me to the next point, and that's, don't be hypocritical. One of the phrases that came up during Rav Lichtenstein's eulogies last year, I think his wife said this, lo natan li atzmo hanachot. Loosely translated, he didn't give himself any discounts. Let me tell you what I felt. He always challenged us to higher ground, and his challenges were very strident, very overwhelming. I told some of the boys, one of the best questions I received 2 weeks ago when I was in New York speaking about Rav Lichtenstein on his hesped or his yard side, from a high school boy in TFUC, give me a little credit, he asked me, Rebbe, did you ever feel depressed that you couldn't reach Rav Lichtenstein's level and challenge? Because it really was very overwhelming. It was surpassing. He didn't pose simple challenges to us. The challenges were very, very transcendent. It was a really good question. And my answer to him, the answer is not important as the question. I'll just mention it quickly. Part of my answer was he was just a very positive person. He was a humanist. You felt his trust. You felt his empowerment. And you never felt that he was challenging you and then letting you fall and judging you and dismissing you because you failed to live up to expectations. But part of what made his challenge so compelling is that you always felt like he was speaking down to us rather than up to us. Now let me explain that, because I'm going to use these terms differently from the way you typically hear them. Very often when people, preach to you and they become very bombastic and pontificating, you wonder, are they keeping those same standards? And when you sense they're not, he says, well, maybe there's hypocrisy here. They're expecting certain demands and challenges and levels of me, and it may not keep up. For example, for many years, I felt like my ability to challenge people to come to Minyan in the morning was hamstrung by the fact that I didn't come to Minyan in the morning. It's not because I was lazy in the morning. I got up at the same time. I still had little kids at home, and I had to help my wife, and I felt it was more important to help my wife escort the children to school. Baruch Hashem, over the last couple of years, now that most of my children are a little bit older, and their morning experience in our home is less chaotic, so I have the ability. And I think that listen to me or not listen to me, I don't think you accuse me of hypocrisy, because I'm here in the trenches every day as you are, and you're able to, less able to, but so I don't expect of you any less than I expect from myself. With Rav Lichtenstein, we always felt like he was challenging us to lower ground than he would expect of himself. That whatever challenge he posed to us, he was outperforming those standards. But he realized he couldn't expose us to such harsh expectations, and he had to ramp his expectations of us and from us down from his own experiences. If he implored us to learn past lunch, he would be there at 1:25, and he'd be the last person to leave the base matter. And we knew he slept the least, and we knew that his davening was... So every detail that he would challenge us to, we knew that in his personal life, he was outperforming his expectations of us, and it created a lot of motivation. I want you to... And it taught us something. I don't always adhere to that, or I don't always succeed at that, but I certainly know it echoes in my conscience. I don't take the easy way out. Or I try not to. Sometimes I fail to. But I don't have this instinctive or reflexive, what's easiest now? What's the easier road? How can I relax? How can I sleep? How can I'm not feeling well. I always feel charged to higher ground. Sometimes I succeed. Sometimes I don't. But I'm not looking to make choices based out of ease. I'm looking to make choices that I feel, and I think a lot of people, I don't want to say they're hypocritical, because that sounds very precalculated and mendacious almost. But I think people just don't want to struggle. They just give up the struggle. It's just, you know, I'll just, lowest common denominator, I call it entropic behavior. Entropic means moving from position of greater energy to least possible energy. I just don't want to expend the energy to stick by my values, to work hard at something, to come through, to get up. And it just stop. They stop the internal process of scrutiny. They stop living, examining life, and they just let things flow. Whatever is most convenient, think about your decisions, make tough decisions. You'll fail, of course, to live up to all of your expectations of self, but I'd rather you have ambition and self-discipline and self-expectation and fail and deal with whatever frustration and depression or despair comes in its wake. Simply just let things flow, whatever is the easiest exigency. So don't discount yourself. Don't cop out, as we would say. Don't be hypocritical. Say, and I don't want to speak in generalizations, and I'm not speaking about your past and about communities, but I think a lot of yeshivas will come out and say, look back at modern orthodoxy and sense the hypocrisy, and because it's so hypocritical, make that change. I'll say it differently, less harsh, more sensitive, more historically appropriate in my sense. Is I look at the gap sometimes between values and implementation and behavior in the communities you came from and try to shrink that gap, because the broader, we're all hypocrites. Life is about hypocrisy. I know that in every group of 50, 18-year-olds, there's one person who's so purist that he renders the whole world hypocritical, and that's a recipe for failure and for doom, because you just negate everything and dismiss everything. Everyone is hypocritical. Rav Aaron was the only person I met that didn't have different shards of identity. I'm not the same person here that I'll be in some other context. Hopefully the gap between who I am as a Rebbe and who I am as a father is very, very minimal. Maybe I dress a little different, but when it's too coarse and it's too radical, then it's hypocrisy. Two faces. He's one face in the room and he's another face at home, and you can even border on criminal behavior, chas v'shalom. But try to shrink the gap of hypocrisy. Try to be consistent. What do you believe in? If you really believe in something, then be willing to live those values at prices. Whether it's price of personal experience, comfort, public ridicule, verification, public uneasiness. If you believe in something, as we would say, be willing to go to the mat for it and be willing to sacrifice something on behalf of those. Yes, Austin.
Aren't many of our values contain calculations? Like, I might have to give this up in order to get what I
sure,
want later?
For sure. But make sure those calculations aren't being motivated by convenience and efficiency. They're being motivated by high-minded goals. And in this case, the two clash in which value they want to prioritize. Sometimes it may happen that there's parity between the higher value and convenience. So don't be afraid to choose convenience as long as it's being driven by value, not by convenience. Okay, sometimes convenience is important. I covered up real, so I'll talk about this later with parents and with friends. But that sense of living values, it speaks about idealism before, but now I'm making it not just a sentiment, but a tool. Ask yourself, am I choosing an easy approach or am I choosing the correct approach? And don't be afraid to sacrifice on behalf of the correct approach. That's number two. Number three, I want to introduce a word. I've shared it with certain boys when we've had these end-of-the-year conversations, but we've started to have with certain boys who are leaving early because I'll be away for a Shavuos. Rav Lichtenstein introduced a value into our lives and in particular into their professional decision-making process that I hadn't heard articulated before. And let me give you the context. I think part of Rav Lichtenstein's legacy is that he's accurately sensed that he lived in the post-war arena in which most of the educators in Rabbanim were either holdovers, old school, literally, survivors, broken people, shattered personalities from the Holocaust, or people of minimal talent who backed their way into education. There's an old expression, not just in the world of Judaism, but if you can work, if you can't, then teach. Basically, yeah, teaching is a fallback. I mean, you can't be successful professionally as a doctor, as a lawyer. And he felt that tremendous sense of historical duty to exhort and to train a new generation of talented educators who could have been successful in any field they would have chosen, chose education out of a labor of love, a great personal sacrifice, because they were passionate about educating Am Yisrael and teaching our people. And I think you're all the beneficiaries of those people. Most of your Rebbeim, as I'm looking around the room, come from that generation. Some of them were directly influenced by Rav Lichtenstein, and some of them obviously were just part of the general social milieu that Rav Lichtenstein helped contribute to and helped weave. But it was that sense of duty, that in the 1980s you have a duty. And when I chose education, I had great fear in my heart. I was uncertain. I didn't know whether to be successful. I didn't know whether to be able to hack it financially. But I was driven by duty. I wasn't driven by personal enrichment, satisfaction, expectation. I felt an overwhelming sense of duty. And at times in my life where I wasn't successful education, where I was first cutting my oats and trying to find my career, what is my duty? How often do you make decisions that you're not drawn to, but you feel dutiful to perform? It's my duty. Well, that's part of living an adult life, responsible adult life. Much of parenting, especially during the younger years when you're more of a giver and you're more of a contributor, selfless contributor, your duty, get up, it's your duty to get up. It's your duty to supervise the health of your child. It's your duty to be their parent. It's your duty to be a responsible role model. It's your duty to radiate proper values. Now, hopefully you're able to connect and associate duty with authentic belief. It's not just my duty, it's also my thrill to radiate those values. But when you think about it, you shouldn't be embarrassed to make decisions based on what your duty is. And I'm not sure if that's a pathway of thought that you're too accustomed to. I don't believe it. And today happens to be in America, there's an American crowd, Memorial Day. And just think about, especially some of you that experienced Yom HaZikaron a month ago, and sadly enough, how, I don't want to say this disparagingly, but how, how frivolous Memorial Day is when there's so many families and people who have committed so much because of a sense of duty, because they were receiving any. And their families are just as shattered and just as crushed. And Baruch Hashem here, we had a day in which we celebrated people of duty and a nation of duty. And if you can become people of duty and dutiful people and make decisions based on that, and that's a whole new factor to introducing your decisions. I'm talking to some boys about Shana Bad, and I wonder if that means, like, it shouldn't only be whether you want to come back Shana Bad. It's, do you have a responsibility to talk to Shabbat? They spend more time than best matters. Okay, so there are parental inhibitions and collegiate restrictions and financial issues, but some of you have a green light. Again, if it's going to be of diminishing returns, you don't want to return, but not, you shouldn't just choose it because you're excited to come back. Again, you can't feel that it's abhorrent or repulsed by the idea or terrified by the idea. But is there a sense of duty that can lead you to some very important decisions? I just chose Shana Bad because it's a more recent conversation I have with some boys. But I want you to carry that sense of you that now that you've lived this type of life, you've seen people that act upon duty, not just upon convenience. So that's number three. Number one, the lifestyle of steadfast commitment to Talmud Torah, halacha, shmiras mitzvos, coupled with an openness and engagement, a respect for the complexity. Life is different. Life is subtle. Life isn't black and white. It is doctrinaire. Number two, a sense of not discounting yourself with easy choices, whatever those factors are that incline towards ease. Number three, introducing duty and trying to become someone who lives duty and is proud. I feel at certain points in my life, and of course this borders on obsessiveness, but dutiful people can quickly transition into obsessive people and compulsive people. But sometimes I feel dissatisfied, almost jaded, when I don't feel like I've performed my duty. What's my duty? It sounds strange because typically duties are onerous and responsibilities that you take, but once you realize their impact and their enhancing value, then you long for duty and you long for opportunities to perform duty. You're in a class of, oh, this person took this responsibility. What have I done with you? What have I've just sat here receiving. I haven't performed any duties. So hopefully that's just an alarm signal. Number four, fancy word. But I think I heard this today at a Levi, and I like the way the person who gave the eulogy said it, and I'll transplant it to your experience. I think that life in Israel and life in a yeshiva in Israel creates a sense of verticality. And I'm not sure how much verticality you sense. Some more, some less. Some of you have greater historical awareness, some have less historical awareness. But coming to Israel, living in Gush Etzion, seeing boys going to the army, a sense of you're not just a point somewhere, and your life can't be defined as an isolated point, but you're part of a line, and you're connected to your past, and you're connected to your future. And how can you be honest to your heritage as well as inspiring to your descendants? How can you be part of that long, great chain of Jewish experience that struggled so mightily, that was predetermined by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that was chosen, that has marched proudly facing so much opposition and hostility and discrimination? And somehow, again, some of you had this, I don't want in any way to be demeaning or devaluing of what you had. Some of you, in living in America, in some cases, an historical dislocation, strange as it sounds, but sometimes I look at certain American parts of the American experience as historically dislocated in general. And 200 years ago, you probably lived in the same house as your grandparents because people had less. And then 100 years ago, you probably lived on the same street. You live right next door. And 50 years ago, you lived in the same city. And now transportation and communication have deluded us into believing we can maintain that verticality at great distances because we can Skype and hop on a plane. And to a degree, we can maintain relationships, but that sense of history, and that you have to live life in sensitivity to that history. And obviously, for many people, that's the driving force behind their aliyah. For many people, that's what it comes to. For me, that's what it came to. My professional road was far more paved, far more promising, far more optimistic if I'd stayed in America. I was right at the cusp where I had performed and I had received those first-level entry jobs, assistant rabbi here, and assistant teacher here, and assistant... And now I was facing all those long-term offers to be the rabbi of and the teacher of and the increments in salaries, which are commensurate with those upgrades of professional opportunity. And I realized it's now or never, or not never, but it would be now or 30 years later. And it was clearly bartering my future or my present for my future. And I mean my future as a person, but my future in terms of my descendants, that I would relocate my family. So I'm not saying this has to compel every person's decision. It's a balanced decision, and for some people, remaining in America is, at certain stages, the optimal decision. But that sense of verticality, which can exist even in Chutz La'aretz, that you're living a narrative that can't just be condensed into Highland Park, Dunkin' Donuts, and ice cream. It's just everything becomes very, very cramped and very myopic and very cycloptic, if you're into Greek mythology. That people have this one eye, and all they see is their reality, and the reality that expands in front of them, and I live in Central Avenue, and what are the pizza shops, and what are the restaurants, and what are the teams, and somehow you've broken out of those shells of your respective communities, because as youngsters, you couldn't see more, you weren't traveling, you weren't seeing differences, and as I think one of the great assets of being here in Yeshiva, you've been exposed to so much, you haven't just remain within your shell of 50 American students having a fantastic experience in the land of Israel. But you've seen there's a broader fabric and a broader patchwork, even the contemporary Jewish society, because you've seen people your age, your own peers from South Africa, from Australia, from Israel, and let alone you've lived in a land of history and you have a sense of building history. All that together should create verticality. And I think verticality is a real compulsion. So that, I don't know, it's Friday night, you're in the university of whatever, and you're invited to an inappropriate setting, and you have an impulse to go because you'll enjoy yourself. And he says, yeah, but down the line, I'm dislodging myself. That's not what is expected of me. That's not what I'll be proud of. I'm not contributing to that great train of Jewish. I'm just taking, even if you take a break, and it's an unfortunate break, put yourself back into that verticality as quickly as possible and say, my standards and my codes have to reflect that vertical progression that I'm now proud to be part of, that so many people are laying so much more on the line for. I've got friends that are serving in the army. Think about, sometimes it helps to think very, very concretely. Next year you have this opportunity and you feel an impulse or a desire and you know that it's unhealthy and you know that you feel yourself unable to resist it. Say, well, my friends are now sleeping in a tent in some soggy, muddy riverbank up north, protecting my country that one day I want to live in. The least I can do is behave in accordance with their commitment and my expectations, and just sometimes that concrete sense that you're part of something larger can stabilize and steady the decisions you make. So that's number four, verticality. Number five, I really discussed this before. When I thought of verticality, I thought of the combination between hashkafa and avodas Hashem. Where your hashkafa here is very horizontal, stretch out, and halachic observance tends to be vertical. How should I eat matzah, and how should I make kiddush, and how should I put on tefillin? So let's just leave it at four values. Don't discount yourself. Have a sense of duty. Have a sense of this combination between unflinching commitment to halacha, and then if you solidify that, then you have the license and the luxury to stretch your wings or expand your wingspan. But if you don't, then that expansion can allow the center to collapse. If the center is never sturdy, then expansion generally leads to the dissolution and the crumbling of a structure. And then finally, that historical and national verticality. Okay. Now, so instead of three and five, it's three and four. So three, four, and eight. What are the eight tips, like practical tips? What you should be careful about? Again, this is all just off the cuff, just thinking about over literally a few minutes and jotting some ideas down. I don't you think this is the be-all and end-all. I think number one, I think that the greatest asset and strength of a place like Yeshiva is the confidence that we imbue within you that this is a lifestyle that works and everything is under one roof and Rebbeim here can teach you how to crack a sugya, how to decipher a sugya, and the values to lead your life by, and you don't have to compromise, and world-class Talmidei Chachamim and Tanakh. And I think it's hard for you to imagine any value that you're really passionate about that you really don't get exposure to here, either directly or indirectly. I haven't taught you algebra or world history, but you know that I value those fields of study in their proper proportion. So everything you value, you see, we deliver and we institutionalize within the curriculum a higher dosage of certain values and lesser dosage of other values, but not that we dismiss value. And sometimes it creates one of two related attitudes that I think are very dangerous, and they really are related. Much, if not most, of the Torah passion across the globe, outside of Israel, outside of Alon Shvut, certainly in the United States, is driven by a community that people would call Haredi. That's a gross generalization, because that community itself is in one. It's not like Haredi's control and command center where there's one person distributing, dispatching orders to every single person with a black hat. So just like any culture at a distance, just like Asians all look the same to Caucasians. So black-hatted people all look the same as if they're all operating in the same frequency. So the next time you see a Lubavitcher, don't you dare call that Lubavitcher a Haredi. He'll be very insulted. And the Haredi person will be even more insulted that you call the Lubavitcher a Haredi. So I just said that just to show you how inaccurate our generalizations are. But that's really where, by and large, with rare exceptions, the large active Batei Midrashos, the davening, which is very serious-minded. Again, obviously there are exceptions. And I think sometimes, as one of the Rebbeim put it, Ari, I'll give you a little shout-out to Rebbe Parnas. You know, today everyone has to be a nosher. Everyone is noshing a little from here and a little from there and a little from this Rebbe, a little from that approach. And I don't think we've taught you to be noshers because you've been sitting at a table with one large integrated banquet because everything... I mean, a few years ago, we actually tried to adjust this because we never had the need to bring in guest speakers because we have so much talent and so many world-class personalities that people are begging, right? Where are Rebbeim on Shavuos? Half of us are away because people are begging us to come and speak, and we're always speaking in different communities and different continents. So, okay, why should we invite so-and-so? We can invite Yael Ben-Nun to speak, in-house talent. And we realized that we were just redoubling your inability to nosh from others because you leave yeshiva. But so as you spend your whole life in Gush, the dangers of that integration may be nuanced. But when you leave yeshiva, then again, you have to take your position along with all the other people who are noshing and are receiving. So I'm always horrified by a conversation I had with a boy, really 20 plus years ago. He lived in an out-of-town location, and I asked him, what are your plans for the summer? He's taking courses, and where will you learn? He says, there's only one base matters in town. I won't fill in the city, so it's not to defame any one city or person. There's only one Beis Medrash in town, and it's the Yeshiva Shulcha, right? I forget the word he used, I would never step in there. I was mortified. I said, let me give you an example. Let's say you're Chas V'Shalom, a kidney patient. And there's only one hospital in town offering dialysis, and it was St. Lutheran's Hospital. Would you say you're not going to step into that hospital? Well, Torah is your dialysis. It's your oxygen. It's not just your dialysis. How can you imagine living your life without contact with Torah? And let's assume that you're going to be less successful learning on your own in your quiet of your room where you have distractions. This is before internet. Then you will be spending an hour a day in that mismatch. I know it's hard. I know you feel judged, whether they're really judging you or not by the color of your shirt and the length of your hair. Most boys aren't. Most of the people are not. You're just projecting your feelings to them as if they're projecting, as if they're judging you. But even if they are, so have a little spine, a little backbone. Sit down. Don't try to preen around, but go in. And I spent many, many fond years of my life in summers in the Chaim Berlins of the world, which is right near my home in Brooklyn. And then when I was in yeshiva here, when I used to go to visit my relatives in Beit Vegan, I used to learn in Kol Torah, which was a Shlomo Zalman's yeshiva. And then in the wherever there was a Beis Medrash, Yehi Chalkim Yosha Beis HaMedrash, or some Chalkim Yosha Beis HaMedrash, I had wonderful conversations. I met wonderful people. Again, sometimes I'm a little bit too nostalgic for my own good. I don't remember any snide comments. No one came over to me with any judgmental statements. And at the very least, I gained to meet different people, to hear their input and view, and I feel that sometimes Jewish guys are not as adept and adroit at that. I know it's not your fault, because your experience hasn't been patchwork the same way it is in some of the other yeshivas, both ideologically, because this is a staunchly nationally religious, and I think some of the other, even Hesder yeshivas, are more patchwork, and also because they've been exposed to a more steady stream of visitors, whereas here we've tried to introduce visitors, but it's clear to you that this is, so what makes yeshiva so powerful for you sometimes can be a peril. Number one. Relatedly, it can lead, and I'm sure some of you heard this when you were applying to the yeshiva, by people who discourage you from coming to the yeshiva. Be careful, because guys come out of Gush very arrogant and cocky and balei gaiva, and then exhibit humility. And there are many parts to that question, and that was really a conversation we had last year when I was trying to help you understand fact from fiction, smoke from fire, what it's based on. Is it a myth? Is it real? But there's certainly a sense, again, because you've been exposed to so much, and that's what makes it potentially so powerful, but certainly a sense of, I was in the yeshiva. This is a flagship as the yeshiva. This is the yeshiva of Lichtenstein. This is the yeshiva of Amital. I have a great rebbeim, especially Rabbi Tarkin. I have a great rebbeim. So, you know, I'm sad. I don't need to listen to that rebbe, to this rebbe, because he doesn't represent to me the entire package or the full formula. It's a little bit related to the ideological spoiled or the ideological exclusivity, but it's more, as a person, are you humble? And it was so odd, because Rav Lichtenstein was such a humble person. He was so non-judgmental, but it was hard to see, because he was just so spectacular and transcendent in that respect. And people sometimes come out of this yeshiva a little bit, again, you're bright boys, so that's another handicap, so to speak, in achieving appropriate humility. You've had so much under, and it's that combination, and this is also an education of empowerment. Remember, a lot of yeshivas, the foundation of their education is submission. This is the value system. This is the dogma. You're expected to submit your personality, to submit your values to. And obviously religion is about submission, but we try to empower you. We try to give you the tools of learning. We try not to make it my way or the highway, only one way to think. So that combination, that you haven't been suppressed, no one has come over and suppressed you intellectually. As forceful as we tried to be, as passionate, we tried to be passionate, it's always been very respectful. And that you're all bright, so you're all kick back, so to speak, you're live wires. And the fact that everything's been under one roof can sometimes lead not just to talent, but to cockiness, either in nature or in style. Sometimes it's just about the words you use and the body language. And sometimes people tell me, oh, that boy, you come from the yeshiva, he's very cocky. You know, it's not just, he just doesn't know how to convey his ideas with proper humility, because he's so developed and talented, and he's not just 19 years old, but he's precocious, he speaks like a 25-year-old. And sometimes people that are very mature and expressive, they're mistaken for cocky or arrogant when they're not kids anymore. They're 20-year-olds who speak like 30-year-old adults. But that too is important. You should convey, you should learn how to convey your ideas with the appropriate humility that I think you've seen in us. I hope you've seen us as passionate, confident, expressive, articulate, coveting, very demanding and challenging and convincing, but it's been said with a certain degree of, hopefully, intellectual humility, that ours isn't the only one. And to me, if you can take that from the yeshiva, I'd always steer that line You'll be morally very, very fit and very healthy. That's number one. Again, they're really one and two, because it speaks about ideology and being able, I guess a good phrase to use is I want you to be a little bit more colorblind. If you can become colorblind ideologically, I think it'll be very healthy. If you can be a person that walks around and doesn't really get caught up in hats or jackets or gargloch or kippot sugot, it just takes every person in life, not just Jews. But certainly if we shrink the fabric to the Jews you'll meet and shrink it even more to the Orthodox Jews, I'm in no way devaluing other people. I'm just focusing on hopefully the people that will represent the primary fabric of your experience. You'll live in Orthodox settings, you'll interact with Orthodox people. And so you won't look for divisions and create divisions, but you'll look for that which unifies people. And I get caught up, and you'll gain so much from people. And unfortunately, my feeling is sometimes there's a bit Haredi phobia because the challenge is so staunch, and people, instead of trying to rise to the occasion and match their performance, sometimes have an easier response and just bashing them and trying to find their faults, and they all steal parking spaces, cheat on taxes, and dance during Yom HaZikaron. So why should I even respond to their challenge when they're so morally corrupt? And it's just not true. And even the people who don't keep Yom HaZikaron, it's based on really deep ideological conviction that you could disagree with. I mean, one of the 20th century figures I have most respect for, that I would love to spend an hour in the room with, is Satmar Rebbe. I couldn't disagree more with his opinions. But the degree of commitment he had to Judaism and to Jews and the Avas Yisrael that he exhibited, and I felt he really was concerned about me. While he was defaming me, it was because he was concerned about my well-being. He didn't want me to be a Zionist because it was satanic. And if I thought you were involved in something satanic, I would try to intervene. Okay, so the language and the style and the positions, they can all be up for debate. And to be able to leap beyond ideology and just see real people and their values, and you can learn so, so much. And there's so many people that are dedicated to lives of Torah and mitzvot and then beyond, other values that are important to you. And you simply starve yourself by cutting yourself off from these sources of inspiration and from growth. Okay, we're running out of time, so I'll just be a little bit brief. What about the people in your life that hopefully you can inspire? Now, that's a very heady and heavy term. I don't think anyone's going to have a press conference on the tarmac and say, okay, Benny, now that you're back, tell us the truth of life. You know, have a press conference, and what do you think about so-and-so? And the throngs of people will say, okay, we're changing our lives based on you're young, and people still see you in that light. But over the long haul, hopefully, a life of steady, principled ideals and values will be inspiring. Don't expect it to happen in 5 years, but it will happen eventually, and even over the next 8 to 10 years, as you start, because now it's very easy to dismiss your lifestyle because you have no pressure, you're not paying any bills, you're not raising a family, so it's very easy to believe in values. How do your values stand up to the test of time, to the test of real life? But once you stop becoming, so to speak, a real person, and you're married, and you have children, and you're earning a living, married community, and you're exposed to the stresses and challenges of humanity, and if you're still able to maintain that steady lifestyle, people are inspired. Wow, he really believes in his values. They come first. He lives his life. They forge his identity. But in the immediate sense, you will have challenges with parents and with friends if your parents don't automatically subscribe to either the values or the implementation of those values that you are sincerely engaged in or inspired by, and obviously friends. It's a complex issue, but I want to give you the following general guidelines. First of all, respect and perspective. And let's start with parents. In many cases, your parents had certain pressures affecting them based on how they were raised, based on maybe they were children of Holocaust survivors, maybe culturally came from very different locations and weren't exposed to Torah. So that's part of the generation. I hope my children will far exceed my Torah accomplishments. I really do. It'd be my greatest joy for my children to exceed me. And that's how I see myself, as a pedestal or a launching pad for the next generation. And I allow them, and I want it to be a robust launching pad with coiled springs so they can leap as far as they can. But that's part of the passage of generations. When I was young, I didn't have the resources. I don't mean financial resources, but I didn't have the religious resources that I feel I've tried to extend to my children. Will they? Will they not? That's their decision. But I hope that they exceed me, but I hope that they look back at me as the provider of these opportunities, and they don't judge me. So to say it in different terminology, and I'll talk about this next week when I talk about Yom Yerushalayim, oddly enough. It took, in many cases, more courage for your grandparents to wear a kippah in public than any accomplishment you'll have, serve in the army, become a Rosh Hashiach, or just walking around in public in middle America in 1950 wearing a kippah was major heroism, just like it was heroic for your great-grandfather to keep Shabbos in 1930 in America, wherever. Now you're talking to the Sephardim here, may have come from situations of greater distress. Okay, but they may not be well-versed or educated. They may not understand the value or the implementation of Talmud Torah. But that should ease, hopefully, some of that tension and friction, to know that you're not defying your parents just because you're choosing a slightly different method of implementation. I don't think anyone here is going to choose radically different values. If you took your parents and put them in a room and say, do you believe in Torah? Yes. Do you believe in mitzvahs? Yes. Do you believe in Eretz Yisrael? Yes. Do you believe in Midah? Yes. Okay, now in terms of the implementation, for whatever reasons, it was hard to express them. Now, I know it's harder to convey this to your parents, and you know, some parents have what I call generosity of spirit. And as a parent, I've tried to be extremely, extremely careful about that, letting my kids find their own identity, hoping that they would build that identity more or less within the parameters that I've established for them. And Baruch Hashem, I'm very gratified. And my children are not like me, and they made different decisions, and decisions I've made. I'm extremely proud of the decisions they've made, and I see them as very, very consistent. And obviously, I'm still a work in progress. Mirz Hashem, Bezos Hashem. But some of your parents are more able to grant you that latitude and flexibility. And for whatever reason, some parents are less able. It could be emotional. It could be all sorts of issues that it's not appropriate for me to describe, even in theory, even in abstract, let alone specific. But people are people, and people have greater capacity and greater confidence and greater, and some people are more worried. And all of it, I'm sure, in most cases, is sincere. It might not always come out as sincere. Sometimes conversations can become hot-headed, and sometimes... And the best thing you can do in any conversation when it reaches that moment of hot-headedness is just to say, when you feel yourself becoming hot-headed, don't leave yet, Zach, because I want you to hear this, to say, I don't want to talk out of anger. I don't want to wait till I calm down. We can continue this conversation. Now, that could be said in two ways. That could be said in a polite, humble way, or it could be said in a pugnacious way. I don't want to talk out of anger, which just makes it even more hurtful. So you just say very quietly, I'm still learning to speak properly and to contain my emotions, and I really don't want to say something. And everyone's going to say, no, just give me 5-10 minutes just to cool down. That's a sign of maturity. It could be said, unfortunately, in a very, very hurtful way, so make sure your body language and the style you use, and so to keep you in, because it's very important. I've seen a lot of relationships between parents and children rise or fall. One, the ability to have civil, honest conversation, and at some point, you have to have the capacity to say, your parents may not grant you that wish, but you have to have the capacity to say, this is my life, and I'm trying as sincerely as I can to build my identity in lieu or in line with your values, but at least give me the chance responsibly to express them in the manner and the proportion that I'd like to express them. And I'm not betraying any of your values, but at least let me express them differently. And as long as you're making responsible choices, if my child decides I want to go take drugs and spend 5 years on a beach in Venice, I would say that's not a responsible choice. So you don't have the right. As long as I'm your father, you don't have the right to act irresponsibly or to take behavior which is self-destructive. But as long as you can prove that others have taken this path responsibly and other people have, whatever it is, Shanabat, moving to Israel, going to Chinuch, becoming more, for whatever, being a little more makbid on this, a little makbid on that, it could be hurtful because, again, I don't want to be too specific, but any time a person challenges your orthodoxy and your religious standard, even implicitly, it could be hurtful, and therefore you have to be aware of that and obviously make sure that the entire body of work compensates for that you're humble and loving. A lot of it has to do with not what happens in your conversation or at those points of conflict or clash, but it has to do with the overall body. If they see that you're a good son and a good brother and a good grandchild and careful and responsible and sensitive and you're committed to the family, so they know that your migration towards greater religious intensity isn't an act of betrayal or rebellion, it's just simply finding the identity that you feel drawn to. But if it's coupled with hostility and antagonism and irreverence and disregard for family, then your parents may be right. This is just your fuel for rebellion rather than something which is sincere. So check yourself. Make sure that your overall body of work is respectful and constructive and investing in your family and your parents' well-being. And then, okay, but now that it's davening, I really want to daven in a shul that's a little quieter. I want to be careful about this halacha, or I'd rather spend time at home learning an hour rather than going to the movie. Or if we're going out, let's make sure that, especially during the summer, that we factor minyan into the equation. Where we're going to daven mincha, and it's important to me. And you can quote this story. Rav Lichtenstein gave a speech about 15 years ago. He was in the city, and the title of the speech was very baiting. I tried to bait him or entangle him, flipping out or firming out, what should we expect of the Israelis, something like that. And he began every lecture critiquing the titles, especially the sensationalist titles. He refused to be baited into saying something sensational. And at some point in the comment, I wasn't there, but it's a very famous comment, he said that he has a son, as you know, became a little bit more Haredi, and came home and challenged the kashrus of this kitchen. Now, this is a kitchen which is being run by the Rav Soloveitchik's daughter and supervised halachically by Rav Lichtenstein's mashgiach. So it's hard for me to imagine a level of kashrus superior to that, but as you know, certain sectors have different expectations of kashrus. And Rav Lichtenstein asked in a very open-ended, provocative fashion, what do you think my wife and I did? And I'm sure there are people in the audience who are saying, you gave it to him, you disowned him, you kicked him out of the house, you made him sleep on the couch, you force-feed him, you gave him an enema, you know. He said, what do you think we did? We gladly adjusted. And his point was, they're your children. Just like if a child came home and said, he wants to play basketball instead of soccer. My son, this just switched from soccer to basketball. So we adjusted because my son expressed a need. So now my adult son expresses a need. So we'll make that adjustment. I'm the happiest joy. My child comes home and expresses respectfully, Dad, I have this need or that need. I don't like chocolate ice cream. Could you please buy vanilla ice cream for shops? I'd run out in a second and buy vanilla ice cream. So it's a two-way street, and obviously there are a lot of very, very charged conversations you'll have with your parents, and less conversations with friends, but same thing with friends. It has to be true that your friendships now have to reflect your changed identity, or your changing identity. You can't just feel that it's an overwhelming moral responsibility to maintain and to feed, I'll get back to that word feed, every single friendship from my past. You shouldn't be rude, shouldn't be arrogant. You're now role models, and people will look to you rightly or wrongly, hopefully rightly, and they'll make extrapolations. They'll say, oh, I'm just picking Elon because he's sitting in front of me. Elon was in yeshiva for, you know, in your community, yeshiva is not a given. You're in yeshiva for a year. They'll see you talking during davening, and they'll translate that, well, if Elon is talking during davening, I don't have to be Shomer Negiah. What does one have to do with the other? Now, obviously, they're looking not to be Shomer Negiah. What? Zereshava. They're looking for an excuse. They're looking for justification. It's not fair to you. But, well, if your religious observance is faulty, then mine can be as well. That's the logic. It's not fair to you, but life isn't just about being fair. It's about doing what's right. And if your performance, Behana performance, is artificial and authentic, but your posture and demeanor during davening can be impeccable and not leave room for, oh, if he can do this, I can do that. If he can do this, I can do that. And it may be hurtful. My general guidance with friendships is as follows. You should never be rude. You should never, ever truncate a friendship because you never know when you'll be needed and when that friendship can be revived, when that person will reach out to you. But you shouldn't be averse to forming new friendships based on your new directions in life. So, for example, just to pitch it within the high school milieu. When you were in high school, you were friendly with the cool guys, the alpha males socially, everyone, or the girls, everyone gravitated towards. And the nerdier boys, not that any of them ended up in Gush, and the nerdier boys, you were less apt. You don't really want to be friend with that person. And all of a sudden, that nerdy boy went to yeshiva in Israel, maybe Gush, and became very, very religious. And you find there's a common language between you two. And if religion really is important to you, then it should be the baseline of your friendship. Well, how do you choose friends? Just based on social skills and confidence or cool? Or do you choose friends based on common values? And that's the person. I remember this distinctly. There's an image in my mind. I can tell you the guy's name. Image in my mind. Someone was in high school, two boys in high school with, that people really weren't that friendly with because they were socially awkward or withdrawn. And then all of a sudden, when we came back, I started to become friends with them because I just enjoyed reinforcing my values, listening to them. I never let my other friendships suffer, but sometimes if you don't breathe life into a friendship, so it I don't say it dies on its own, it expires on its own, but it just withers and friendships are changing. There's no question, I'll say this, you won't understand, there's no question that when you're young, you overestimate the durability and hence the impact of friendships. The people that you're friendly with, certainly from high school, it's very, very, very unlikely they're going to play a major impact on your life. You're not going to choose where to live, in most cases, based on where your high school friends are. It's hard for you to see because you're right in the wake of those high school friendships. But interview parents. Ask your parents this question. Parents who had, so to speak, parents who weren't relocated from place to place. And say, how many of your high school friends, not to get on Facebook, maybe things have changed a little, social media, but how many of your high school friends really do you live with and dive in with and build a community? It's usually a community based on education, based on resources, based on location, based on how far it is to your work, based on the shul. And then you become friendly with people there. And maybe I'm less of a friend, man. Certainly I'm less invested in friendships than the average person, but it doesn't really... Don't worry, the holy friendships, and if I betray those friendships, I'm a mockery to myself and to my past. Friendships transition and morph and change as you go through life. And certainly don't be rude. And loyalty means you're loyal to the people of your past. And when you come across them, so to speak, you don't want to be disrespectful or demeaning or judgmental. You don't want to give them that sense. But if you have a choice, what to do on a Motzei Shabbos, and some of your friends from your past are making decisions that are unhealthy, you don't have to feel compelled, oh, for the sake of the friendship, I'm going to go see an inappropriate movie or go to an inappropriate setting or act. That's not a just equation. Friendship is not the highest value, the apogee of the pyramid. It's a part, it's a value, and it has to be calculated within the values. And certainly positioning yourself in healthy situations and healthy behavior should trump, in most cases, excuse me for saying that word, should over-tally friendships. We're finished. Let me just end with one statement. I didn't really get to some of the things I wanted to talk about, but I hope this was helpful. I think you also have to question decisions. I'll just say this in one or two sentences. I don't want to take your time unnecessarily. Not just based on the halachic legality and validity, but is this a place I should be? And especially for boys on campus. It can't just be, is it halachically mutter? Is the food kosher? Is this the place I should be on a Friday night when people are drinking or people are acting with leitzanus and kalas rosh towards women? Or should I be in a casino? Should I be in, especially when you're living in tightly woven Orthodox circles, you have these questions from time to time, but they're less frequent. Once you enter the broader world, you really have to shrink your yardstick and say, use this phrase. I hope you can use this phrase. When I strip everything down, okay, I hope everyone in this room will become a Talmud Chacham. It's very hard. You need to spend 6-7 years in a Beis Medrash. And I hope everyone will become a Yirei Shamayim. But it's hard. It takes a real inner authenticity and inner striving, inner honesty. But again, these are terms that I'm making up, but I'm not making them up, but I'm assigning them along the totem pole of Orthodox identity. But I would hope that every boy that comes in this yeshiva sees himself, if not a Talmud Chacham, striving to be a Yirei Shamayim, but at the very least a Bentar. A Bentar means someone that's been exposed to Torah, as opposed to just someone that's Orthodox. That'll be the next level. A Bentar, and I know that a Bentara doesn't just ask what's Mutter Asur, but asks, is this reflective of someone that lives under the general influence of Torah? I studied Torah, I was exposed to Torah, and if that somehow, if that identity can help you make decisions, this is not a place I should be. This is not an environment I shouldn't be. Give you an example, something that came up, but just I'm sure there are dozens of examples, and I don't even know, and you can speak to people that are more intimately familiar with life on campus. But someone told me, on some campuses, there are football games and college campuses, and if you pay ahead of time, you get a bracelet, whatever you can have. So that's dealing with this issue from a purely halachic standpoint. If the halacha matches, and I'm not violating any of the Yisurim, so I've kept Shabbos. But that's your Shabbos, to be in a stadium with... I can't imagine. I mean, it hurts me to imagine. It's not obvious to people. It's not where you're sitting on Shabbos in a stadium with 50,000 people screaming at a football game. And halacha can be kept. I'd be shocked to find a bentar over there. And hundreds of other decisions. That's really, to me, one of the questions, the guiding parameters of life on campus. It's not just about whether it's mutter or asur. It's about, is this the behavior and the setting, the language, the people that I should be interacting with? Anyway, I'll stop here so I don't take too much time here. Hopefully.